wherever you may be. Welcome to Observations. I'm here with Scott and Kirk. How are you, fellas?
Great, thank you.
I'm good as well.
Good. I thought we'd pick up where we left off regarding Moody Jeff. And maybe we can finish Moody Jeff today, at least make a good dent in it. For those who have not listened to all of the Observations program or just began with this one for some reason, Moody Jeff is a fellow that went to Moody Bible Institute. His father was a Christian pastor. He became a youth pastor in a Christian church, served as there for about 5 years. A little braggadocious on his education and what he studied. And he copped an attitude towards Yahweh's testimony in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, which put us at odds with each other. For those who have listened thus far, you'll probably note that Moody Jeff and I are not best buds. I made an attempt to what I thought was to provide what I thought was really a thoughtful and mostly positive response to his very long letter, up to the point where he wrote what I'm going to share with everyone now. At which point, any attempt to be civil with him evaporated. I don't care what you have to say about me. I don't care what you have to say about the United States. I don't care what you have to say about Christianity. Don't care. I do care when you make a disparaging comment about something that Yahweh has conveyed to us, especially in his Torah. So at that point, I'm just not accommodating. Now, for those of you who don't know any better, and think that, well, that's not a very nice thing to become judgmental of someone and to be critical of them just because they say something that you disagree with, I would say, by whose standard? Mm-hmm. When Yosha was confronted, that would be the actual name of the person that Christians are clueless regarding and have named Jesus, was confronted by similar individuals, those with religious training. Did he say, oh, you know, I can understand how you may have been misled, but oh, by golly, you know, let's just sit down and talk this through. It's not that you're completely wrong. There's some room for growth here, and I just love you, so let's see if we can work this out, and I want to listen to what you have to say and consider your point of view, and then maybe we'll work out a compromise and our understanding.
You got to stop. I'm going to throw up.
And by the way, that was Yosha's response. You got to stop. I'm going to throw up. That was exactly his response. And then he spewed out far more critical and negative statements regarding the those who were steeped in religion than what I had to say to Moody Jeff. The fact is,
I think this even transcends Moody Jeff as much as what I got from so much of this was. This is a viewpoint, at least at this particular point in time. This was a viewpoint of people, so many Christians on their against. If there's such a word of Yahweh and Yosha everything. So, mean, if we attack the message even more than the messenger in this case, I mean, it's just because it's pervasive in Christianity. All of us have encountered all of this at one stage or another.
Yeah, and that's why we're covering this. Moody Jeff means nothing to me. Based on his attitude, I think the likelihood of him coming to know Yahweh and becoming part of the covenant is extraordinarily remote. He didn't mean a thing to me. Now, I understand there's some covenant members that are more accommodating than is my approach, and they're working with him and see some possibilities and hope in him. But you know, the fact of the matter is the only reason we're going over this is because Moody Jeff represents a significant cross section of our world,
yes,
particularly the English speaking world. And his attitude towards God and God's testimony is consistent with them. And so by going over their arguments, if you will, their perspective, their attitudes, and responding to them, for those who are listening to the program who encounter similar people, which most everyone will, as you have.
Yes, indeed.
There's some an opportunity, to recognize, you know, this is at least one way that you can respond. We're not saying that our response is the only way to respond, but yeah, this is a way to respond to those sorts of things. And as a member of Yahweh's covenant family, it is our responsibility to be prepared to respond.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of any family. You got to know what the family holds dear, what the family finds unacceptable. And it's important for you to articulate the family's position and defend,
yes,
the family's position. So here, I'm not defending my position other than if you were to look at my position as our position as it relates to the covenant family.
Yahweh's position. Yeah.
But because really the covenant family is Yahweh's position.
Mm-hmm.
So as a covenant member, to become part of the covenant, it was necessary, if you will, for me to accept his position. Now, I don't have to accept his position on everything, but I absolutely have to accept his position on his word, on his plan, on his path, on the terms and conditions of the covenant, on his nature, on his purpose. On the big issues, you either come to know and accept his positions, or you're
on another page.
Or you're on another page in another place, and it isn't part of the covenant. So I would say that I'm a really independent individual. I'm really bad at compromise. I have an authority complex. I really dislike authority. When somebody says, you have to respect the office or respect the man, I said, no, I don't. I have no respect for stupidity. I have no respect for religion. I have no respect for politics. I have no respect for the military. I don't respect any of those things. I don't have respect for, in America, the Judicial Department, for example, DOJ. I don't have respect for any of that. I don't respect the currency. I don't respect many things. And so, my tendency, Kirk, you're probably not as belligerent as I am, but my tendency is to, when somebody says, you either have to accept my way or it's the highway, I will always choose the highway. The only time in my life that somebody has given me what really is an ultimatum, it's my way or you're on your own, that I've accepted is Yahweh's.
Well, since I was very young, teenage years, when I started discovering how wrong everything is, the histories, the religion, I mean, to whatever degree, and then, of course, I came a long way in the last 10 years, so I've finally got y'all's perspective.
Yes.
No, it's I've been against forever, but most of the time it was so overwhelming I just walked away from it. It's like kick the dust off your shoes and go, because I couldn't debate them as well, or even when I could, they didn't want to hear it, so there was no debate, so you couldn't engage people. So
We're in the same boat. We're the same boat in terms of human authority. But
Right. Now,
it's what's interesting is that Yahweh does not demand that we accept his way. He lays it out there and says, if you want to accept it, here are the benefits. If you don't want to accept it, here are the consequences.
Yes.
Really simple. So he's not demanding, he's not ordering, he's not commanding us to accept his way or there are consequences. He's just saying, this is what I'm offering. If this is acceptable to you, wonderful. If it isn't, see you later. Well, not see you later. Never see you. It's really that simple.
Does he compromise?
No.
Is he even going to listen to you trying to compromise?
No. You can't negotiate with him. He's non-negotiable.
Ask Ishmael.
Ask Abraham about Ishmael. Yeah, he is absolutely unequivocally non-negotiable. Now, some of us say, well, you know, Abraham negotiated with him. No, he didn't. Abraham questioned him.
Yeah. You're allowed to engage in the conversation.
Yeah, I question him all the time. There are lots of things that Yahweh has stated that I question. And there are some where I have questioned and I do not agree with his position. I would say universally, when I do not agree with his position, it is it's indicative of me not understanding the circumstances well enough, and I'll acknowledge that. But things that, you know, I don't agree with his position on every issue. I have accepted his way on everything that is germane to our relationship. So the issues where I question and I have not, where I don't agree, you know, maybe an issue, for example, of, well, I understand why some of this is challenging to process, to come to understand what Pesach, Matzah, Bekorim, Shabuah, Teruah, and Kippurim and Sukkah represent. Well, it's a bit challenging to find specifically what are the five terms and conditions of the covenant and what are the five benefits. While it is difficult to have an appreciation for the fact that the Ruach Kodesh, the set-apart spirit, represents the maternal manifestations, of Yahweh. While it is difficult, somewhat, to figure out the proper pronunciation of Yod-Heh-Wah-Heh as Yahweh, well, there are things that are more difficult than I wish they were. And I would have preferred, you know, if it were, you know, I get to lay out the plan and the way the plan is communicated, which I would have preferred to make at least a bit easier to find. There isn't any statement that Yahweh's made, any requirement for participating in the relationship with him that I disagree with. And ultimately, the reason that I've come to accept his authority and no one else's is because of who he is, how he presents it, and what he's requesting. He doesn't come at us as an authority. He doesn't approach us as a lord, doesn't approach us in a fearsome way, doesn't come off as imposing. Considering who he is, he's extraordinarily humble in his approach.
Which is odd when you think in terms of Paul's encounter in Syria.
Well, of course. Yeah.
Also,
that's impossible.
Yeah. Also,
that's totally uncharacteristic.
Put into terms what he is. Mm-hmm. He's the creator of all.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know about you, but if I even build the stairs right,
right,
I'm pretty happy about those stairs, and I kind of gloat about those stairs.
Oh, that's right. You and me both. You and me both. I accomplished something in my little mundane world, and I'm pretty proud of the accomplishment. And it's crude compared to almost anything that God has done. I mean, I understand his awesomeness, but for considering his awesomeness, his approach to us is extraordinarily approachable.
Miraculous?
Miraculously approachable. Kind, gentle.
He wants to be known like a person.
Yeah, I want to be known as an individual, and the role I want to play in your life is as dad.
He says, please, and then gives you everything as volitional.
Please consider being part of my family. Please consider...
Please
pay attention to what I have to say, because it's really in your interest. And so he is so non-authoritative in his authoritarian, maybe is the best way to say it, authoritarian in his approach, that I didn't feel put off. And then as I considered what he was asking, I came to realize that everything he was asking, you can even use the term requiring.
Mm-hmm.
Attendance at his Moed Mikre, at his invitations to meet and be called out. Requirement. But they're parties. They're a celebration. They don't cost me anything, and I gain tremendously by them. Okay, so you know, require away. The five terms and conditions for participating in the covenant, every one of them is a benefit to me. And, of course, the benefits are out of this world. So, you know, you look at what he's asking and you say, well, you know, it's not like the U.S. government, which is belligerent and will throw your tail in jail if you don't capitulate and has the muscle and the will to do that and is in the process of taxing you and limiting you in almost every possible way. He's in the business of saying, I don't want anything that you have other than you to take some time to engage in a relationship with me. Not asking for anything. I don't want your money. Absolutely don't want your money.
Yeah, what are you going to do with it?
Yeah, don't want an oath of allegiance.
Mm-hmm.
Just want you to engage in a relationship.
Don't want you to bow down.
No, don't want you to bow down. Don't want you to worship me. Don't want you to blow smoke. I'm never going to ask you to pray to me. Never.
That is so in the backdrop of Christianity, that's so bizarre.
So bizarre, yeah. Uh-huh. And so he is approachable just because of his nature. Now, as I share now what Moody Jeff wrote, the problem here for Christianity and for secular humanists is that religious buffoons, absolute jerks, have created a false impression that the Torah is a set of laws. Mm-hmm. And Torah does not mean law. And they've created this impression that God is a mean-spirited disciplinarian who has imposed a bunch of arcane laws that you either obey or he's going to burn your britches in hell. And that such a God, they know, is sadistic. He would not be lovable. He's not approachable. And he's not relevant. And so that is the lens through which the vast preponderance of people. Yeah. Christianity is the biggest religion.
Yeah, most people, period.
Yeah. At, 2.5 billion people. What secular humanists mm-hmm. have been indoctrinated to believe.
Right.
Now, there is no Hebrew word for obey. God never once asked you to obey him. Never once. And Torah does not mean law. Torah is the kind of thing that a genuinely loving father, and by loving father, you know, I define love in the same manner that Yahweh presents it. Love is not all this syrupy, sweet, emotional stuff. Love is doing the right thing for the right reasons in a relationship and being willing to make the sacrifices of time and energy into the relationship to do what is in the best interest of those that you're engaged with.
Mm-hmm.
So
good definition.
Yeah, that's Yahweh's approach to love, and so he is really centered on, I'm going to tell you what you need to know, and I'm going to tell you what's not good for you. I'm going to tell you what's good for you. I'm going to educate you the best I possibly can. And I want you to trust me to take care of you in every possible way, here and forever. And that's the approach. That is what the Torah is. And as a loving father offering to do that for his children, you would expect Torah to mean exactly what it does. The Hebrew word Torah means guidance, teaching, instruction, and direction. That's what Torah means.
Yeah. And the
right. And the two words that Yahweh uses consistently relative to his Torah is he asks us, the two verbs that he uses are Shama and Shamar.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to my teaching and closely examine and carefully consider my guidance. So that when you recognize that, then you realize that the next thing you need to realize is that in Yahweh's seven Moed Mikra, he's got seven annual meetings, which the first four of which provide all of the benefits of the covenant. That you first realize that the animal that is sacrificed on these is sacrificed the same way that the cow is sacrificed if you have a hamburger.
Mm-hmm.
The chicken is sacrificed if you go to KFC, and the fish is sacrificed if you go and do what I did for lunch and have some salmon.
Mm-hmm.
You can't eat the animal alive. Someone has to kill the animal, and then the animal is cooked and prepared to eat. And that has been the nature of omnivores, like humankind, from the beginning. And so if you're going to have a feast and a party to an association with that feast, and each of these seven Moed Mikre are feasts, you need to have some food. And food includes meat, high-protein meat. And Yahweh's view, his favorite happens to be lamb. So the sacrifice isn't a sacrifice in any sense that we would consider. You know, if the U.S. federal government requires you to sacrifice your a percentage of your earnings as a tax, they're taking it from you. Whether you choose to give it freely or you give it under duress, you're sacrificing your income to the federal government or the state government. Yahweh doesn't require us to give him anything. We're not making a sacrifice for him. We're eating
the lamb. We're eating his meal.
You eat the lamb, right. We're feeding our families with the animal. And the animal then represents something that conveys an important truth about what Yahweh has done to provide the benefits of the covenant. So that's the context which they should be envisioned and understood versus the context that they are wrongly conveyed. So this is what Moody Jeff wrote. What kind of answer can you possibly have for how ritualistic and seemingly pagan all of the Levitical stuff is? I mean, from ceremonial washing to the animal sacrifices to doing it this way and only this way sounds a whole lot like religion. And between that and slaughtering the Canaanites, they seem to be like your typical Bronze Age people group, minus the possibility of child sacrifice. Now, when somebody writes something like that, my response is, well, perhaps you've misunderstood. My response is instead, do you have any idea, moron, who you're criticizing? Have you ever stopped to think for a moment who wrote what you call Leviticus? Have you ever even conceived as who the author might have been that inspired that book? And then if you think for a second, who inspired it? Who are you to criticize him? You say you want to get to know them in the first part of your letter, and then you're willing to write this about him? And you think he wants to know you? You think that somebody in his family wants you to join? Go to hell. That was my response before I started writing. Now, I'm open to criticism. Any part of that, you guys say, well, you know, maybe you're a little harsh.
No. No, it's a Yahweh wrote it. You don't have to believe it, but I, you know, even what I've been studying lately, when you start studying these Canaanites, if you just study a little harder, you find out Yah didn't ask you to do nothing, even those things, when he asked them to wipe out, not the Canaanites, the Amalekites.
Right.
When he does that, then it was a reason to save you, protect you,
right,
build your home where you'd be safe. And he was justified in all of that, and easily approved.
Yeah, in fact, let's take the wiping out the Canaanites. The Canaanites were a tribal group of people that were there in Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Israel, the country, in fact, the planet. Whose is it?
It's Yahweh's. He created it.
Yeah, he created it. So it is his, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the Canaanites themselves, are they human beings?
Of course.
Well, who created them?
Yahweh.
Okay. All right. So is he the source of life, of temporal life?
Yeah.
Right. So
there
he gave them he gave them their temporal life. So if he were to decide that, you know, I gave them on average 20 years of mortal existence and said, but I don't want them to have 21. Was he did he do something that would be considered inappropriate for them, or did he give them something they would not have had anyway?
Well,
what's the net situation?
21
to them?
Years would be a gift.
Well, you know,
it's
what my point is that since they would not even have existed if it were not for Yahweh, if on average they lived 20 years before he said that's enough, then they had a net benefit of 20 years and there's no negative. If the entire reason that something exists is because you've created it, when you don't want it to exist anymore, it's your prerogative. Now, somebody say, well, you know, that's not true. If you conceive a child, you know, you conceive the child and it's so you can take his life. Well, no, you didn't. You didn't make the sperm. You didn't make the egg. Took two of you to get together, and the mechanism for life, you had absolutely nothing to do with. You were not there to write to DNA. You didn't create the elements. You didn't come up with the plant. You didn't conceive life.
You didn't have anything to do with it any more than I have with the breath I take. I don't know why my lungs do what they do. They just do it.
They just do it. Right. And so that was the first part. The second part is that it really wasn't the Canaanites that the Israelites were asked to eliminate. It was other tribes. The Canaanites had virtually ceased to exist by the time that the Israelites returned back from captivity in Egypt. And the reason that they were in captivity in Egypt is there was a terrible drought. They really had no choice but to migrate to a land that was flooded by a river and had a river as a source of water because of climate change. And so that's why they were there in it. And the native peoples of that area, the Canaanites, essentially faded away. Now, that doesn't say that there weren't some native peoples. You did a study as to who the native peoples were at the time of the return. This would be not the time of Abraham, but at the time of that Moshe leads the children of Israel out of captivity in Egypt and has liberated them. And he has then promised them an area that represents 1/100 of 1% of the Earth's land surface that he has, that really is all his anyway. But he promised them 1/100 of 1% for a fairly important purpose. In that 1/100 of 1% of the land's surface area, these people are going to serve as his messengers to humankind, a message that can be used, and the only message that can be used to survive mortality. That's it. And what Yahweh wanted to do is to say, listen, the things that are important to me is that you be set apart. You have to be set apart from normal human influences. That means human government, human religion, human military schemes. If you're going to serve as an example of my covenant family, you have to be set apart from these things. You can't intermix with them. So this little tiny region at the crossroads of the world in Israel, it was imperative that those who were overtly political, religious, militaristic, harsh, cruel, be removed. And if you want a metaphor, the metaphor is if There is a an abandoned house that is given to you as a as an inheritance on a farm, and the and there's foreknowledge that in that house it is filled with poisonous vipers and rats that are that have been infected with bubonic plague and vermin with rabies. Are you going to say, come on, family, let's all move in and let's all live together happily ever after? Or are you going to say, you know, before we move in there, we need to remove the venomous snakes, the vermin with rabies, and the rats that are have bubonic plague? Well, the remnants of those peoples that were in Israel, and it was about 5 to 10 villages, really no cities, but 5 to 10 villages of tribal peoples. What did you learn about them, Kirk?
Well, I went down a different road I wasn't expecting. There was obviously some small tribes and people there, but what had happened, and imminently provable, and one day if you want to, we'll go through all this, but just take my word for it that all accounts agree any direction you go in history. When Moshe came out with the children of Israel out of Egypt, that left a great void there, because remember, a couple of things were happening. It was rather an upheaval that destroyed Egypt. Everything was really destroyed.
They left. The ten plagues.
Oh, yeah,
actually occurred.
This wasn't a minor little event.
Right.
This was a major event.
Right,
and recorded throughout all that region as well.
And Mitzrayim, which is what we call Egypt today, actually it's not what the Egyptians call Egypt. They call it Mitzra from the Hebrew Mitzrayim, which means crucibles. Their refusal to let their labor source, their slaves, go.
Yes.
The consequence of not letting the slaves go is exactly what Yahweh wants humankind to understand. If you're a religious or governmental or military institution, and you try to control the lives of masses of people, as the Roman Catholic Church has done, as the Islamic religion does, as the U.S. military has done, as the Roman military, the legions, did, if you try to control lots of people, there is a tremendous consequence. And God wants you to know the consequence. And it's going to cost you your children. You're going to be plagued as a result of doing that. And so Mitzrayim was set as an example to display to us the consequence of imposing a nation's will, an individual's will, against masses of people, essentially enslaving them, whether by the use of economics, the military, or by use of religion, all of those human institutions. So, and the consequence to Mitzrayim, Egypt, was devastating.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that, as the Pharaoh had second thoughts and decided that he was going to go and slaughter the Yahweh's people after all of these things had happened. He was swallowed up in the Gulf of Aqaba, and so he lost a significant part of his army, and Egypt lost its pharaoh, and so things were really bad in Egypt. They were extraordinarily vulnerable for a long period of time. So that's where your study began.
Well, yeah, and what I discovered, and it doesn't matter whether you go to the Torah. Or you go to, there are Egyptian accounts of exactly verbatim each one of these catastrophes. There's the Hermitage in Leningrad. Mm-hmm. There's the stones there. There's the El Ardish stone that describes who came in. And on and on and on and on. And I mean, it just goes pages and pages and pages. But but I reduced it about 5. But what happened when you have a void in what the Arabians down in Arabia?
Mm-hmm.
You had a group of people called Amalekites.
Mm-hmm.
Amu was the Egyptian names that they called them, and they were later known as the Hyksos. But those were the Amalekites. They left in huge numbers. They left going up the coast, going towards Egypt. And originally they were just going to get out of all the trouble they were having down there, which was the same events that were occurring in Egypt. They, in turn, wound up, they didn't run across Moshe, because you remember they have a battle with the Amalekites.
Right.
And about the same time, within a few days of them leaving, these people are starting to enter Egypt. Now, there's no, according to the Egyptians, according to every source you can find, and there's plenty of them, there's no army there to protect the Egyptians. Their
Correct.
Land is devastated. All those
Correct.
Plagues have killed off their food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And these people come in, and when you read about the Amalekites, you'll find out they were the most horrible human beings you've ever encountered. They cut off the arms. They did. They raped the people. They murdered the people.
They were Muslims. Everything. They were Muslims before Islam. You know, it's
Absolutely.
Interesting, of course,
they
is
were
that
the prototype.
Right.
They were
right.
the prototype,
it's,
which is interesting because God always shows you something in the past
right.
that's going to happen in the future, and so forth.
Right.
And so on.
Right. In fact, it's really interesting too. Most people don't know, but the first some 30 or 40 surahs of the Quran in chronological order, in the order that they were revealed by Muhammad, are universally plagiarized from what's called Hanif poetry and the Hanif religion, which is the religion of those Arab tribes living in the area of Yemen.
Mecca, yeah.
Yeah, south. Well, actually, not Mecca. This would
well,
be.
Was,
they,
yeah.
He
coastline, yeah.
He used the coastline down there in Yemen.
Uh-huh.
And then he blended that in the next, like, 30 surahs chronologically with the mythos and the religion of the Meccans. And what you find is that these religious rites and these people were vicious. And so it's why in Islam there is so much viciousness in the Quran, where the Quran tells you to cut off people's heads, to cut off arms and legs on opposite sides, why Muhammad told his goons to go murder women while they were breastfeeding children. It's why he led 75 terrorist raids, and after a terrorist raid, he'd actually bludgeon people to death and then gloat over their bludgeoned bodies. It's why Muhammad himself was a rapist and encouraged his men to commit acts of rape, why he was a pedophile. The kinds of despicable actions that were perpetrated by Muhammad and the first Muslims were usurped.
Nothing,
usurped.
Even compare, though, to what
right.
the Amalekites were doing on such a larger scale.
Yeah. So the Amalekites served as the foundational basis of the first some 30 to 60 surahs of the Quran chronologically.
Amazing.
Yep.
Yeah. And then, of course, they dominate Egypt. Mm-hmm. They start to dominate Israel, you know, the what is now Israel. At that time, of course, they were wandering in the desert for 40 years. They couldn't mm-hmm. get in, or they chose not to go in when Yah told them to go in. And they walked away, and then they tried to invade it again, as you know the story, and then they lost, and they were the next generation comes 40 years later before they can't enter.
Mm-hmm.
And what they're fighting against, of course, when they do enter, when Yahshua does it, they're
yes.
still fighting the Amalekites again.
Right.
And they name the names, and you can put them all together. And they are joined with some of the other tribes that grew up and so forth, but they're still fighting this thing. And it wasn't really until then it kept on going. I'm going to make a real overview here.
Right.
You go right back, you keep going, and next thing you know, by the time you get to Samuel and Saul, he's told, he takes 140,000 troops or whatever it is and 10,000 Yehudi, and he wipes out the king of the Amalekites, who was mm-hmm. still in power from Israel all the way down to Egypt. That was the last king of that dark ages of Egypt. And it was the most fascinating little journey. I was blown away. And then and all the scriptures tell it from everything from Psalms 78:49, when he talks about Yahweh tells, he says that Yahweh sent forth these fierce angels, these evil angels. Well, God doesn't have any evil angels. That's the way the English translates.
Right. Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't use the bad guys.
Right.
And if you start looking up the words and everything, and you find out that with just a nuanced difference, you don't have evil angels. You have these. You have a king shepherds, is what they were called in Egypt, the Amalekites.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost the same word minus one letter.
Mm-hmm.
In the translation, and then he. So he used them. That was the 11th plague. The Egyptians called that the 11th plague because they came in and took over. And then when Saul has to, you know, Saul got in Israel, one of the biggest, the last big trouble he got into that really was the death knell for him, he was told to wipe out these Amalekites. And he goes to the town, which is Sur.
And by the way, with the term that Yahweh uses of them, he says that their iniquity, their evil, their wickedness, their malignancy it was, and then full, absolute, absolutely complete, to the point where it would not have been possible to be any worse.
Yes.
So way, way beyond what you would call salvation, way beyond any hope of ever becoming part of God's family. They were as too far gone to be reached. They were vicious. They were rapists. They were pedophiles. They were mutilators, child sacrifice, everything that you can imagine. Bad. They were.
Yeah, it's beyond belief how bad they are when you study them. And more so it's this battle that goes on constantly between the Israelites and these Amalekites, even though there's some Edomites and other people that are joining with them and everything, and even some Philistines at one time, is still being run by Agag, which was the last pharaoh of Egypt that was an Amalekite. And they finally, Saul finally puts him to rest, and then he makes a fatal error, which God just, I guess, couldn't forgive anymore if he could at all at that stage. He kills all the people in the town like he's told to. He doesn't wipe out. I mean, he takes some of the treasure, which he's not supposed to do. It was not for their gain. It was to get rid of the, it was to clean house, not to make a gain.
Right.
And then he lets Agag, the king, go. Sets him free.
Yeah.
Yahweh said, wipe these people out. They're going to come back and get you, and they're going to come back and get you, and they're going to come back and get you.
Right.
And he doesn't do it.
And plague your home.
Uh-huh. And then David tries to finish it off in Samuel after that. And amazingly, throughout all of time, it's this same type of character, actually from the same places of origin, doing the same things against Israel. They fight this battle constantly.
Mm-hmm.
I was stunned.
Yeah, and they're still fighting it because
they have. God says they're going to. He
right.
Says they're
why
is the Amalekites from generation to generations?
Right, and they're still fighting them because today the people masquerading as Palestinians, the Muslims in Israel, are modern day Amalekites.
Absolutely.
As a matter of fact, racially, they are as close to Amalekites as they could possibly be. They have no racial connection whatsoever to the Philistines. But
no,
as Arabs, they have absolute racial identity with the Amalekites. That's who they are. And they are every bit as vicious, as cruel, as terroristic, as immoral as the Amalekites, and they're as deadly to live next to as were the Amalekites.
Yeah. It's just, it was just amazing. It was absolutely amazing.
Yeah. See, God, and God's not inclusive. That's people that don't understand that. He's not inclusive. He doesn't love all the little people. He doesn't love all the little children. He is not all loving. To be loving, he hates that which is harmful to those he does love. He loves his children. He loves Yisrael. And so anything harmful to his children, anything harmful to Yisrael, he is opposed to. He's not accommodating. He wants his children to be set apart, to be distanced from the like of the Amalekites.
Mm-hmm.
which would to be today's world, it would be Islam. It would, you know, there's not much difference in the Amalekites in the way that the Romans acted or the Spartans acted or the Carthaginians acted. But the Amalekites were just an extreme version of vile. And so that's the reason why they were chased out. Now, there's other things in his list here. He talks about the fact of slaughtering the animals. Slaughtering animals. You know what's interesting is that there's this conversation that is between Yitzhak and Abraham. That if you really read this and think, you're left with a conclusion that is that's extraordinarily important, a perspective that very few people have. And this is the conversation. I'm going to pick this up in Bereshith, Genesis 22:7. And Yitzhak, you know what Yitzhak means?
Just laughter.
Yeah, laugh and play.
Happiness.
And play. Yeah, laugh and play. And Yitzhak, that's Isaac, Abraham's son. Mm-hmm. And Yitzhak spoke to Abraham. Now they're climbing up Mount Moriah. And Yitzhak spoke to Abraham. Abraham means father who rises up, who lifts up, and who stands up. Father who reaches up. Father of the abundantly enriched, merciful father, as well as on the negative side, father of multitudes who are confused and troublesome. And Yitzhak spoke to Abraham, his father, stating, father of mine. Now, it's interesting the way it just begins. Father, father, father. Even Abraham is based upon Ab, meaning father, and Raham, meaning to raise up and lift up. Mm-hmm. So the name father is in Abraham. He said his father, stating father of mine. So God's trying to say here, there's a father-son relationship here, and that's what the covenant is all about. So he responded, Hena, here I am. Look up at me. Pay attention to the details of this discussion presently, right here and now. I'm here. My son, Ani Ben. Then he asked, behold, Hena, pay attention. Pay very close attention, noting all of the relevant details. The fire and the wooden pillars. But where is the lamb for the elevating offering? Now, you just read that and you say, oh, well, you know, of course, the lamb, you know, Passover, that kind of thing. And you say, well, lamb does mean Passover. So, first of all, you're saying they were going there to celebrate Passover. Mm-hmm. Whoa! Because what happened exactly 40 Yobel, 2,000 years later, on this exact same place with a father and son regarding
Yosha.
Passover? Yosha became the Passover lamb. Where is the lamb? Oh, the lamb is Yosha. Be right here in exactly 2,000 years, my son. Don't you worry about that. Figure it out. They were dress rehearsal for Passover and drawing attention to the lamb. Now, that ought to be enough to be earth-shaking in terms of your perspective. But the first thing that I did is saying, wait a minute. Why is he asking for about a lamb? There weren't any people in the world at that time that were sacrificing lambs, much less engaged in eating lambs as part of a meal to have a relationship with their deities.
Yeah.
So I began to study this.
Yes.
The question regarding the lamb, while seemingly subtle, affirms two profoundly important aspects of the adventure to Mount Moriah. For him to have recognized Yitzhak that they needed a lamb to roast on the fire requires an understanding of the Torah. Abraham had obviously shared it with him, even at an early age. And even more revealing, they were intending to celebrate Passover, just as Yosha did 40 Yobel later on the same mountain.
How else would he know to ask the question if he wasn't informed on all
that? That was correct. Now, as proof that Abraham and Yitzhak were operating out of an entirely different playbook, one composed by God and in universal conflict with the rest of humanity circa 1968 BCE. In the cradle of civilization, indeed, Abraham's birthplace, the Sumerians were sacrificing humans, not lambs. 6 years ago, archaeologists at the University of Pennsylvania reached this conclusion after conducting CT scans on the skulls of over 2,000 victims buried in 16 golden tombs in a single royal cemetery in Ur, Sumer. These researchers reported that human sacrifices were conducted on a very large scale. The common characteristic of these ancient remains is that two 1-inch diameter spikes had been driven through the heads of the men and one through the women while they were still alive. Their bodies were then baked, albeit not burned, and then doused with mercury so they wouldn't decompose and could be put on display during religious ceremonies. Abraham's countrymen sought to appease their gods through religious mass murder. Yitzhak didn't say, where are the slaves?
So we can kill them.
So yeah. We can go murder them to appease our gods.
Yeah.
Especially wanton during this time, the Sumerian and Egyptian lords, priests, and kings had countless servants, concubines, musicians, handmaids, grooms, guards, and soldiers murdered in mass because their clerics claimed that the dead would continue to serve their masters in the afterlife. Worse, the Phoenicians and the Carthaginians sacrificed babies to their gods. In one cemetery alone, urns containing the tiny bones of 20,000 ritualistically murdered children have been found. This is what God wanted removed from Israel, from his home. It has recently been discovered that the Greeks practiced human sacrifice, as did the Romans through the 2nd century BCE. The Mongols, the Druids, the Chinese, Japanese, Mayans, Aztecs, Incas, Polynesians, and Africans prolifically, barbarically, and religiously sacrificed innocent human lives on behalf of their make-believe gods. So the only reason that Yitzhak would have asked his father about a lamb is because he was aware of Yahweh's instructions regarding Passover.
So, yeah, I don't have any trouble with you wiping those people out.
None.
I mean, you don't have any problem putting them in prison or a mass murderer putting them to death.
You know, I was bit cleaning out my garage of the home we have here in Ohio by a brown recluse. And had my wife not driven me to the emergency facility and the physician not recognized the nature of the bite and given me the antidote for it, I would have lost my leg, maybe my life. When I came back home, I didn't say, may the brown recluse and my family live here in harmony together. No, I called out fumigators, and I had every blankety-blank spider in this house, around this house, in the garage, killed.
Good.
I didn't feel badly about it at all. It was my responsibility to do that. And that the brown recluse is far less deadly than our humans poisoned with religion and politics. Man is the most deadly animal.
Animal on the earth is destroying the earth.
By an unfathomable amount. Man's the most deadly of all animals, and particularly man infected with religion. Allahu Akbar acting as terrorists. You know that the first Muslims, after Muhammad's death, wiped out half of the human population in the first 100 years, called the Golden Age of Islam?
Yeah, the Golden Age.
Yeah. Is there any other circumstance where you, where any other animal in nature has wiped out half of the population?
No, not even lions kill all the hyenas.
No.
Your food source.
No, absolutely. So that's the first part of it. The second part of it is that the Hebrew word for that is typically stated sacrifice is olah. I didn't read it as sacrifice. I read it as the elevating offering. La olah. It means to approach by rising. Olah is from Allah, A-L-A-H, which means to ascend and to go up, to be withdrawn and to be carried away. Now, is there any way from olah, which is based on the verb Allah, to ascend, to go up, to be withdrawn and to be carried away? Can you get sacrifice from the actionable root of olah or from olah itself? How in the hell does anybody in their right mind translate olah as sacrifice? Well, sometimes they translate it as burnt offering. Well, how do you get burnt offering or sacrifice from a verbal root that means to ascend, to go up, to be withdrawn, to be carried away?
They get it because it fits the narrative that they want to spew.
That's the truth.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's a burnt offering that's a sacrifice. You're sacrificing an animal that's a burnt... But guess what? When you're cooking the lamb for Passover...
Yeah.
Is God's instructions to burn it up?
You get all the nourishing parts.
No, he wants you to cook it, right?
Yeah,
and the only part that you burn up is after the fact. You've fed your family. You've taken all of the nourishing parts. And the parts that are not edible, you burn up.
Mm-hmm.
So there really is no burnt offering.
No.
And what does God get out of this? Smoke? Oh boy, you just burnt some fat.
Mm-hmm.
You just burnt some bones. You know, have you ever smelled burning flesh?
Unfortunately, yes.
Yeah. It's disgusting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I've actually just smelled my own burning flesh. I got third-degree burns. First, I guess, is the worst. I had first where they the blister up and then the blisters open. Becomes, you know, this can become so bad, I caught myself on fire. And I got first-degree burns over my arm and shoulder. And the smell, oh, God, it's unbelievably bad. You know, it's like the crematorium in the Nazi concentration camps. The stench of burning flesh is just unbelievably bad. Unbelievably bad. So, there is no sacrifice. It's not an offering made to God. It is the reason that the fire is used is the fire is used to cook the lamb so that it is nourishing and you get rid of the, you know, the parasites, anything that can, that, you know, if you eat an animal raw, you're likely to get sick. So you cook it. It not only tastes better, it's eminently safer. And number two is that the fire then is used to eliminate the part that's not edible. And there's two advantages to that. One is that other carnivores don't come into your camp and say, tasty. But that wasn't enough to eat. I'm just going to keep right on going. And how about your children? And number two is that part of the remains of the body, the first thing is that the flies lay their eggs in it and it gets filled with maggots. And it becomes a
good about that.
Right,
yeah.
Becomes a source for disease. So that's not good either. And so it eliminates the trash, eliminates the risk to burn up that part which is not eaten, and it's the perfect means to eliminate the anything that's harmful in the food and to make the food taste better. That's why it's on the fire.
Yeah.
Now the fire has some other symbolic benefits. One,
right.
It provides light, it provides warmth. It draws people together. Lots of advantages.